Hello and welcome to another episode of the Uncommon Energy Podcast. This week, we've got plenty to talk about, starting off with some unexpected results at the Salt Lake City Regional Championships this past weekend. There were also some questionable judging calls and a little bit of a rules discussion that came up after the events of the regional tournament this past weekend. We will, of course, have Guess That flavor text, and we will also be looking forward how the meta does develop from here. Of course, there is the Lille Regional Championships this weekend taking place in France. We will talk about all of that and more on this week's episode. My name is Trainer Chip Ritchie, and I'm joined here, as always, by my co-host and friend Azul GG, who's coming off of a top four run in Salt Lake this past weekend. What's going on, Azul? Gotta be feeling good, man.
Yeah, feeling pretty good. Like I said last week, I think, or the week before, whatever, I've said a couple times, like, I feel like my goal for every tournament this year is to feel like I put myself in a spot to get top eight. And I feel like I've done that at every tournament since Milwaukee. I feel like I put myself in a spot to potentially get top eight, even though, you know, I don't always get to my winning, and I still feel like I made a good deck choice and I played well enough, you know, to give myself a good shot. This time I got the top eight. And thankfully hit Grant Manley in top eight, who I don't lose to. So I managed to get top four pretty easily. And then, of course, I did hit the Gudra, which made things a little bit rough. But still, I was happy with it. I was pretty much content with top eight. Then I, you know, got the mirror match in top, got the mirror match there, got lucky in that. So, but then, going into the top four match, I knew I was pretty much done. So I was like pretty much content with top four before the top four even started. But yeah, ton of fun. I love Salt Lake City as well. A lot of cool places to eat. And I do enjoy the mountains in general, really good scenery. So I do love going to Salt Lake City. So love the regional, great time. And of course, yeah, you were there as well, Chip. So how was your experience at Salt Lake City on the casting side?
Yes, I was indeed there, and I was there as a caster. And yeah, I had a great time. I think we got a pretty good variety of decks on stream. And day one, our like main goal was to try to get a good variety, right, and feature all of the meta decks. And I think we did that with the exception of Mew VMAX, which is pretty funny. And it actually turns out by the end of the tournament, the only meta deck, like the top deck, when it comes to like percentage played in the tournament that we did not feature on the stream at all through the weekend was Mew VMAX. And I think that's possibly the first regional or first streamed tournament since tournaments came back in March that Mew was not on the stream. So some people might count that as a win. Some people were maybe like, yeah, we wouldn't have minded seeing it, but it wasn't like intentionally avoiding Mew VMAX or anything like that. There's just a lot of decks in the format, man. I think Kyurem was maybe our most streamed deck in day one, which kind of makes sense when we talk about the meta share, which we'll get to in a little bit. But yeah, I also love Salt Lake as a regional destination. So much fun. Lots of great food places. Just the vibe of the city is pretty great, with the whole scenery and all of that. And the venue's in a good spot. There's a ton of hotels around. So like, it's pretty easy to like coordinate with people and get together, hang out and do stuff. So it's a really good regional spot for sure. But speaking of Salt Lake City, we're going to get into the results of the tournament. And we're going to just start off by talking about Azul's run a little bit, your deck choice, Azul, why you chose to run it back with the Regis after Peoria just a couple weekends ago, and how you adjusted your list. Because there was definitely a few things that were quite different and some cards that I think people were not at all expecting.
Yeah, so went with the Regis once again. It kind of just felt, it kind of felt similar like my run from Milwaukee to NAIC, where it's like the deck didn't do well enough at Peoria for people to be that concerned with it. I'm sure it was on more people's radar, and I'm sure some of the better players took a look at it and were like, okay, this deck is maybe better than we thought it was, and we could definitely see some of the other top players potentially bringing this again. We saw like Big Charms and Palkia and stuff like that. I saw some Lost Cities in some Kyurem decks, so people were a little bit more prepared, but not to the point where it really swings any of the matchups super hard. And we didn't expect anyone to go super hard to try and beat it. And we didn't think the meta was going to really shift too much. Like a lot of the top decks were going to stay the top decks. The meta was going to be really wide open still. So it's hard to want to concern yourself with one of the smaller percentage decks anyway. So we're like, all right, Reggie's still probably the best play going into Peoria overall. The only thing that we were a little bit concerned about that we thought would be a little bit more hype was Gudra. And then the one of the tech cards that we did play was we did bring the Yellhorn. Specifically to tech against Eskew. It can help against Gudra, but it's definitely not as good against Goodra as it is against SQ, and really isn't like a win condition against Goodra. If it was only good against Goodra, we wouldn't have played it. But it basically gives you an auto win against SQ, or they can't just beat you.
By the way,
Ice Cube.
Ice Cube. You know, he's like got an ice cube on his head. Ice Cube.
He does.
Ice Cube, right?
And they can't just beat you with Ice Cube. So they have to like kind of play the game, you know, more traditionally or whatever you want to call it. And I actually did beat 3 Ice Cubes throughout the tournament. And it also helped me get a tie against a Flying Pikachu deck. So it pulled its weight for me heavily. And I think some of the other guys got some ties against Goodras with it, or even beat a Goodra or two. So even though it doesn't really give you the win against Goodra, it's still a pretty bad matchup. You can cheese them if you draw aggressively enough or they draw slow enough. So, yeah, I mean, it was actually kind of funny throughout my run. I actually played against 0 Mew and 0 Giratina throughout the whole tournament. I don't even remember really. I played against like 3 or 4 mirror matches, though. I played against like a lot of mirror matches. So,
I mean, there was a ton of Reggie in day 2. Like, it wasn't one of the most played decks in day 1, but I mean, the deck is just solid and it had a good conversion rate into day 2. So, I think that's probably where most of your Reggie mirrors came in, right? It was probably in day 2. Or at least maybe in the later rounds of day 1, I guess. But
yeah, I hit 2 of them in day 1. I played against Drew in round 7. I started out 5-0, and then I had my first double, not double brick, but I mean, one of the games I played a supporter every turn and still didn't attack once. So I drew pretty bad against Cyrus playing the Arceus Tina, which is a very good matchup, and I beat one of those in day 2. But yeah, double bricked. Or not double break, but double just didn't do anything against Cyrus in 2 of the games. So that was my first loss. I went to 5-1. Then I played against Drew the next round, who also made top 8 with Reggie's. And we decided to ID, because if we play it out, then the loser only gets 1 winning in. But if we ID, we both get 2 winning ins from there. And I would rather have 2 winning ins than, you know, take the 50-50 and then have to only get 1 winning in after that. So I'd rather have the double winning in, not up against the mirror match. A lot of people told me I was probably incorrect with my choice. If I could go back, maybe I would change it. But I don't know. I felt pretty confident that I didn't want to play it out against Drew in the Reggie mirror and then take my 2 winning ins after that. And then after that, I did beat another. I played against another Reggie and I did win that mirror match. So and then after that, I got my tie against the Flying Pikachu. I was actually going to win game 3, but we just did not even have close to enough time for me to finish it out. But yeah, just getting the win again. I mean, getting the tie against Flying Pikachu, I'll kind of take that because that is a pretty rough matchup as well. So yeah, going into day 2, I was at, you know, 6-1-2, and then I had a pretty steep climb from there. And I got pretty lucky to actually even make top 8, to be honest, because I needed I tied my last round against Grant in the mirror match. So I was at 34 points. But there was expected 10 people with 34 or more points, and my resistance was terrible. So I knew I had to get lucky. And then John Ang tied his game, and then the other person tied with 34 points got 9th, and I won out on opponent's win percentage to get top 8. Where, like I said, I got to play against Grant in top 8, which is a free matchup for me because I always beat Grant. I'm like 6-0 against Grant lifetime. So it was actually in that match specifically, it was funny because game 1, I prized double rock and he got the first attack off. But then I find my heavy ball. I get lucky and find my heavy ball, get my rock out, attack. He whiffs an attack and then I get ahead and go from there. And then in game 2, he had a really slow start, Gigas passed with like nothing else on the first turn and didn't attack till turn 3. So I got the turn 2 attack off and just was able to keep ahead from there. So yeah, it's always, I'm just destined to beat Grant. So I wasn't too nervous about it, to be honest. And then, of course, hit the Goodra in top 4. And even going into it, I was kind of already like content, knew when I was going to get top 4. And I think Hale had already played against Kid and Caleb at that point. So I knew he'd be pretty well versed against our list and in the matchup. So if he, and I knew his matchups against them were a little bit shakier. I think he tied Caleb. So I knew at this point he was definitely going to be, you know, that little bit of extra practice against the Reggie, against some top players in the Reggie matchup. Like, he's going to be that much better off. And yeah, it wasn't very close at all when I went up against him.
Yeah, the game, I mean, you got the down to 2 prizes left in game, or to a point where Hale had 2 prizes left and you were going for the Regice play, I think, right? Or not the Regice play, but you were going to go for the Yelhorn play that turn because you KO'd 1 Goodra and drew an extra card on your stream game, right? In game number 1, got a double prize penalty and just lost right away. But I mean, that's just kind of part of it. We'll talk about the penalties in these type of situations a little bit later on in this podcast. But regardless of all of that, incredible run, top 4. Congratulations, Azul. Going 10-1-4 going into Top Cut. So you did tie 4 games But only lost one match, which is pretty impressive in a 15-round tournament. So,
yeah, only the one loss, like I said, to Cyrus. A couple rough draws.
And it was a double brick, right?
Yeah, well, not quite double brick. I was playing supporters, but I wasn't attacking. So it's like, it's effectively,
I mean, if you're missing attacks, like, it kind of, like, that has to count as a brick a little. Like, I mean, you're playing supporters, but just not hitting energies. Maybe not a brick, but just, like, whiffing way too hard.
Yeah, and that's literally all you're trying to avoid is Reggie is just, like, drawing poorly in two games in a set. I would literally trade not drawing poorly two games in a set to literally dead draw one game every single match. I'd be fine with that.
Scoop games pretty quickly whenever you, like, looked at these hands with, like, stadium, double ordinary rod, two Reggies, you know, like stuff that's just not really working for you? Would you scoop kind of early, or were you kind of playing into a few turns at least?
I would definitely play it a couple turns, especially if I felt like there was enough time left in the round, in the round left still. Like, if I won game one really fast, then I would play out game two, even if I was drawing pretty poorly for a little while, because a lot of the matchups, you're just a research away from an attack, and then you're still favored in the prize trade with Reggie. Like, once the prize trade is out of reach, I would just concede immediately. But, like, if it's just, like, if I was up against a Kyurem, even when they get down to three prize cards left, you can just go attack, 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 and the game still ends in your favor. So, and you never know when you're, because you're literally just a research away from just being able to attack sometimes. So, especially because, like, you're not usually doing nothing. You're, like, drawing a couple cards with Drago, or you're using Reggie gate, and you're still getting another Reggie into play, so you're still, like, kind of progressing your board state towards getting close to be able to attack, but you sometimes you're just not attacking that turns, but you're just like a researcher or a Marnie away. So I would stick it out up until the price shortage is out of reach, and then I would pack it up. I'm not gonna wait for my opponent to, like, completely throw the match if all they have to do is attack three times in a row and basically have three attackers set up.
And I'll just ask you about a couple cards in the list real quick before we move on. I guess maybe one card in the list and one card that is not in the list that might surprise some people. You guys played no copies of Boss's Orders, and you did play the Astral Radiance Reggie Alecki, which is a card that you guys had not played the previous weekend. People have played it here and there. I know Drew has pretty much always played this card. But this has always kind of been called the bad Alecki, right? Because the Evolving Skies Alecki is the main one you want to attack with. But why did you decide Astral Radiance Alecki was worth playing? Why did we go with no Boss's Orders? And also, one thing that does feel a little random that people might question would be the one copy of Pokégear 3.0. If you want to just talk about those three things real quick.
Yeah, so no Boss. We actually almost didn't play any Boss for Peoria. It saved me one match in Peoria, but overall, we came to the conclusion that we don't really need it, and if the majority of our opponents just don't or think we play it, but we don't play it, that'll be a good enough advantage in making them play around it to be in a good enough spot already. And in most situations, in most matchups, bad Lecky does what Boss would do anyways. It cleans up a knockout off the bench to get your final prize cards. Like, Boss would bring something up, knock it out for your final prize cards. Now you just go, okay, bad Lecky, snipe, KO the thing anyways. And it does effectively the same thing in almost every single matchup in every scenario. What a Boss would still be nice, and it does give you a better flying Pikachu matchup. So it would be nice for that. That would have been something that would have been nice. Maybe Caleb could have won his top eight match if we had the Boss, but didn't end up going with it. And then the bad Lecky, I think I mentioned, that's no Boss, and the bad Lecky kind of replaces that. And the only reason we really played the bad Lecky is because we didn't play the Boss, but is more so because we played the Yellhorn, because we were trying to beat Ice Q. And when you play the Yellhorn, it confuses the Ice Q, but if they just retreat it and then get it back into the active and can attack with it again, it doesn't do anything. So you have to be able to repeatedly use the Yellhorn to actually have the game-winning effect of it. And I was able to do that three times throughout the tournament. I played against...
Yeah, the first attack, Electromagnetic Sonar, put a trainer card from your discard pile into your hand. Maybe people might not really be tracking with what that is, because most people think about just the discard two lightnings to snipe 120, but that is definitely a solid option, and that's kind of what you used it for, right?
Yeah, use the Sonar... And you just, like, get the Yellhorn back. Or I use it in a lot of other situations as well. I recovered Ordinary Rods. And it's actually one of your best Pokemon to start with when you go second, because it can kind of cover any situation depending on how your turn plays out. So if you, like, play a research and then don't have another supporter, you can just attach an energy to it and recover your research. Or if you do have a supporter, you can just recover a Quick Ball to get more Reggies next turn. Or just get a Trekking Shoes out of your discard pile or an Ordinary Rod if you lost too many on your initial research or anything like that. And just get stuff back to then have more fuel for your next turn or just later in the game. So it's a really good card. I use it a lot in general besides recovering Yellhorn. And like I said, I played against three SQs, beat all of them. Because I had the Yellhorn. So it definitely pulled its weight overall for me throughout the tournament. Played against Cal and Vaughn with the Palkia. They had the SQ in there, and then I played against Lost Gate Ice Q. And then I played against a Lost Gate that also had the Ice Q in there. So came in pretty clutch for me. Otherwise, I would have probably lost all of those matchups.
Yeah, pretty hard card to beat otherwise. I mean, if you have Boss and they don't have Manaphy, like, you can Boss into the bench and then Aleki snipe it, I guess. But, like, that involves them not having Manaphy, which they usually will. So this really does feel like it was the best card to tech for that situation. So good looks, good call there. Now let's break down. Before we talk about the results of Salt Lake, we'll talk about what the meta for the tournament looked like. And if you remember what the meta looked like in Peoria, this is actually really, really similar. The top five decks remained the same, though the order in which they appear does change slightly. So the most played deck in Salt Lake City was Comfy Giratina V-Star. And this is actually something we talked about last week, how we felt like this had a good chance to be the most popular deck. That does end up being the case, but not by much. Kyurem VMAX being the second most popular deck, only 8 less players on that version. And that's the same top two decks from Peoria, just flip-flopped. Kyurem was most popular in Peoria. Now it's Giratina was most popular this past weekend.
Yeah, so they switched, which I expect. I didn't expect Kyurem to be number one. I thought Kyurem would actually fall a little bit further. My prediction was that it would maybe end up in the spot that Mew ended up in kind of that outside the 100-plus zone. That's kind of how I was predicting decks for this tournament. Like, I predicted, you know, Giratina would be in the 100-plus zone. I thought Mew would stay in the 100-plus zone, and I thought Palkia and Talion would also be in the 100-plus zone. So I didn't get the Mew and the Palkia or the Kyurem. I kind of mismatched. I'm not super surprised to see Giratina be the most popular deck. I think a lot of people really like the deck. I think it's a very versatile deck. It's got a good matchup spread. It is a lot. I feel like just Lost Gate decks in general, though, or Mirage Gate decks, any like Lost Gate or the Giratina decks that play Mirage Gate. I forget who I talked about this. It's like you're going to do something every turn with the deck, but you're not going to always do what you want to do. Yes. Like, sometimes you have to settle for attacking with Cram or attacking with Shredder for your Giratina V-Star. Like, you don't always get to do what you want. You always do something.
You're just passing. Like,
yeah.
Like, I remember in Nick Moffitt's top 8 game against Caleb Rogerson in game number 2, like, Nick was seeing a ton of cards, but he was just getting really awkward orders of cards. He was forced to make really awkward decisions and lost zone good cards, which you're going to have to do with the deck every single game, right? It's just a matter of lost zoning just the right amount of good card resources. And Nick didn't ever pull off an attack in game number 2, in part because Caleb was able to be really aggressive with cross switcher in that game. But it's just, even though Nick was doing things, he wasn't getting to the end goal and, like, really wasn't that close to it. It was like just missing 2 pieces of the combo of, like, Mirage Gate plus Rod to put energies back, or, like, had too many energies in hand and stuff like that. So sometimes it's just, I mean, the deck does get a little awkward in those spots. But Kyurem being the second most popular, it was the most popular in Peoria. I do still think the deck is very powerful. And I think that is really just is what is drawing the player base to this deck, because it has incredibly aggressive starts. The rapid freeze on the Kyurem V just puts on so much pressure, especially because those turns you're going second, you can pretty easily get a couple capacious buckets in your hands to just fill the board up with energy. And if people don't know how to navigate facing down that pressure, you can really just steal pretty quick wins with it.
Yeah, so it has that power. I think the problem with Kyurem is it is a little clunky. It is pretty susceptible to Marnie and Pass. Yes. And the deck, even though it looks like it has a versatile amount of options, it is extremely hard to pivot into attacking with another Pokemon efficiently in the deck. You play a couple switch cards, but to get from, like, Kyurem into Greninja and then still have a follow-up game plan, or get from Greninja into Kyurem or Kyurem into a Palkia, is so difficult. It's not difficult to kind of get to the next attacker or to, like, stop attacking with the Kyurem and then attack with something else, but it's difficult to then set up your next attacker after that. So sometimes you're just, like, very obviously gonna only be able to attack with, like, back-to-back Kyurems, and if your opponent knows that, I mean, just back-to-back 3 projects isn't always, like, the best thing to try and run into, right? So, like, I don't know, I feel like the deck just, like, that's the most awkward part about it. It's like, it's very hard for the deck to kind of pivot around into different options, kind of in an efficient way to then follow up with your next most efficient attacker for the situation. It's just awkward. I feel like that's the problem with the deck. And then, yeah, Marnie Path's pretty good against it. Or Marnie's and Path's.
And then Palkia and Mew switched places from Peoria. I think that was opposite there. Palkia being over 100 players on the deck, 12% of the metagame. Still the deck I think most people consider the best deck. Is that still the case? Like, would you still consider it the BDIF, though it hasn't had, like, insane placements? It didn't win the tournament, obviously, as well.
It didn't win the tournament. There was still one in top eight. I mean, I think like the just like it was hard for anything else to be in top cut when there's four Reggie in top cut, right? It was still in top cut, right? Like you, there was no Sablezard in top cut. There was no Mew in top cut. There was no Zoric in top cut. I mean, it was still there at least, right? And you know, Bradner was on the winning end against Caleb, so there was almost two Palkias in top cut. And then we definitely would just be like, oh yeah, it's still the BIF. There was it went from three to in top cut to two in top cut. And even though there was four Reggie in top cut, I don't think anyone's going to call Reggie the BDIF because I think the deck is not super easily counterable, but like it's you can't counter Palkia and Inteleon. You just can't. You can counter Reggie. If you like Jake Gearhart played two Lost City in his Palkia. I'm sure he was waiting to play against all the Reggies. I'm so thankful I dodged Gearhart throughout the tournament. But you just can't counter Palkia and Inteleon. It's uncounterable, and it has options to counter pretty much any top deck in the format and make those easier matches for. So it's definitely still the BDIF, and I expect its numbers like going into, you know, the last couple tournaments in this format to just increase or it'll maintain. I don't think we'll see it like under 12% of the meta. I'd be shocked if it fell.
I agree. I think it is still going to stay a big part of the meta. And I think people also maybe would have a hard time understanding the grasping the concept of a difference between the BDIF, best deck in format, and then the best deck for a tournament. Because those are not
tournament meta.
Those are not the same thing, right? Because tournament meta is always shifting, always changing. And if you can find ways, especially in this format, because the meta is so diverse compared to something like NAIC in Milwaukee, where there was really three decks that took up 70% of the meta, it felt like. You know, since there is like in nine rounds, you can play five different decks very easily in this meta right now. So I think that that makes Palkia feel less dominant, but it is still, I think, a cut above the rest of the decks in the format as far as just power and you know, options.
Yeah, like I didn't play against Mew or Giratina at all, and that makes up almost 25% of the meta, right? Like almost a quarter of the meta, and I didn't see any of them because, you know, there's so many other decks that you could hit or could play against. But yeah, Palkia is still going to be top dog, I think. I had something else I was going to say about it too, and now it's like slipped my mind. What was I going to say?
About Palkia?
Still going to be the top. Yeah, I was going to say something else about Palkia.
About best deck in format versus best deck for the meta.
So best deck in format just means if you take the card pool, what do you think has the just the most general power level? What deck has the highest power level? Irrelevant of what you're going to play against. You don't think, oh, but what if you hit Flying Pikachu eight rounds in a row? You don't think about that. You're just like, okay, what deck is the most powerful? And that's the best deck in the format, in the card pool you have available to you in the standard format. And then there's the general meta, which is what is generally being played, you know, at the current moment in the meta. And then there is like more individual stuff like tournament meta. Like if a lot of people went back and they played if they had to play the exact same deck for, you know, Salt Lake City Regionals, they would tech for Reggie, right? 100%, sure, right? Yes. A ton of more people would be teching for, if you had to play the exact same deck, you would tech for Reggie. And that's like preparing for the specific tournament meta, right? Like, I don't expect there to be four Reggie in top cut of Lille Regionals. So I don't think you have to tech for Reggie going to Lille, but it definitely is a little bit more on people's radars, right? So that'd be like, okay, how do I predict the next tournament meta around what the general meta is, knowing that Palkia and Inteleon is the best deck in the format.
And then just rounding out the rest of the top six most played decks, because that's what the graph was that we showed up on the stream. We have the Comfy Sableye Radiant Charizard. Or sorry, we have the Mew VMAX at the fourth most played, 63 players on the Comfy Sableye Radiant Zard, and then 60 players on the Hisuian Zoroark V-Star. So that was definitely a big uptick from Peoria last weekend. I guess seeing people, seeing the fact that the deck made top eight gave people a little bit more confidence in Zoroark as a play, potentially.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, that might have been like the boost. I also think, I think Zoroark's pretty good, actually.
I think you just said you didn't like it last week.
Did I?
Probably.
No, but the meta's like getting better for it. Sure, like besides the Reggie matchup, and if you want to tech for Reggie, your deck gets so much clunkier. You could go the full tech route, but you need like Dunsparce, Manaphy, and then even
like
then,
heavy Avery or something.
No, if you just have that, like you theoretically win the prize trade just based on those two if you swing first, right? Because they're 2 KO and you're 2 KO, you're drawing two prizes per Zoroark. Like,
I mean, I guess if people are keeping, if they're copying your list, no boss, right?
Yeah. The boss would make things a lot more awkward for sure. But if you have a Charon's Care or two in there and you pull one of those off, you're still going to get ahead. It is a lot of spaces to commit when the deck wants to be pretty consistent. But, you know, we're seeing Sablezard probably had the worst conversion rate, I would guess. Out of these decks. Maybe Zoroark matches it. Zoroark might match it. But there was a decent amount of Zoroark in day two. So I wouldn't be surprised if Sablezard had the worst conversion rate. Just the one prize decks in general aren't. Doesn't seem, besides Reggie, maybe they're just not that great. And Zoroark, I've said this like every week, Zoroark is the king of beatdown. Like, it'll beat Mew, it beats Palkia, in my opinion, it beats Kyurem, and I think you beat Giratina. I think you're favored against all of those matchups if you're playing a fast, consistent build. You do come up short a little bit to Reggie's, and if your deck does become less consistent because you're attacking for Reggie's, your matchup spread is going to hurt against all of the, you know, the beatdown matchups.
You're going to have a worse time against Palkia, especially. I think, like, your shot against Palkia is going to be you being a more consistent deck than them. Because, I mean, for how powerful Palkia is, like, I think there's no doubt that if Palkia turn one gets two Sobbles, Gradiant Greninja, and Palkia in play, then it's going to, like, just be a great game, right, most of the time. Because it, like, the Drizzile Shady Dealings engine is just so insanely good. But so often, if you whiff that Battle VIP pass turn one, if you don't have heavy Quick Ball and Crobat, which is what some players are on. I know Cal, I played it in Peoria to the second place finish. Isaiah Bradner has been on the Crobat for a while as well. If you're not having those extra cards to kind of get you out of those spots, your consistency is pretty weak comparatively, especially to something like Zoroark, which is, like, much more straightforward, but has, like, a similar power level.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. Yeah, so once you get going in that two prize trade, then, like, Zoroark's going to take over. And, like, Palkia, like, one of the reasons Palkia is, like, so good is, like, when you have the explosive games, you're ahead and in control. But when you have the slower games, if you're up against, like, the Tina or, like, a Sablezard, you're still in a fine spot, right? You still probably turn two attack with Palkia, and you can kind of stabilize after that, whiffing that VIP pass turn one. But you can't really do that against Zoroark. So, unless they have, like, a really, really slow start. But Zoroark is pretty consistent. The deck's, like, pretty consistent when it's built to be consistent, I feel like. So, and I think, I guess the other deck to mention was, there was, I think, Mew. There was still a decent amount of day two in Mew, but they were all towards the bottom half of the one that did get ninth. The bubble was Mew.
And then I mean, Riley and Mahone both got top 32 as well.
Oh, did they? Okay, yeah. Okay. I guess So there was still a decent amount of Mew in day two. So I think Mew had a decent conversion rate. Zoroark and Sable, I think had the worst out of these top six. And then Zoroark seemed to do okay. I saw more Zoroarks than Sable Zards in day two.
Yep. So still a pretty diverse meta. We talked about this last week. One other thing I guess I just did want to touch on a little bit, because last week we talked about how a lot of top players are disliking the meta, and the comment section of last week's video was filled with people talking about how much they are really enjoying this format and love the deck variety. And that's awesome. Like, you know, the most important thing about Pokemon for most people is that they are enjoying it and loving it, right? And if you're enjoying the variety of the format, that is great. And, you know, and we also appreciate the fact that it's just not literally Palkia, 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 Arkintel, Mew, Palkia, 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 which is what it was, right?
Yeah, yeah. The variety is nice. I think the meta is, so a meta is as wide as player as of bad decks our players are willing to play, right? As long as people are willing to play bad decks in a big enough percentage, the meta is wider than it, like, but I guess, like, you're kind of comparing it to, like, to the point of, like, when is a meta truly refined to its optimal point, right? Which could come down to just being, like, three decks being played, right? But yeah, so the meta is only as wide as long as people are willing to play potentially worse decks, right? Sometimes the meta is wide because there is so many good decks and there's so much diversity. I think the current meta is not quite as wide as people think. I think Kyurem is the deck that I look at personally, and Tina a little bit as well, as being a little bit overplayed. I don't think those decks are actually as good as their play rate. Where I think when you look back at previous metas, when Mew was like 20% of the meta and stuff like that, I think, or even 30%, actually, it was like 30% for the first three regionals of the year. I think that was warranted. But Giratina being 15, Kyurem being 14, I think for the power levels of the deck, that's not really warranted. I think we should be seeing an uptick in stuff like Palkia. And I actually think Mew actually might be a more powerful deck than those two, to be honest. I actually really like the new build of Mew. And of course, but the bad thing about Mew, I think, is more powerful in a vacuum, but once the Drapions make their way into the vacuum that's where it becomes a problem. So Mew's going to be a little bit of hit or miss depending on how Drapion-y people are feeling on the day, I guess.
Yeah, and I think that's probably what is scaring people off of Mew and why it wasn't one of those 100-plus decks. Because, like, I mean, all of the Giratina decks are, for the most part, playing Drapion, right? So if they Drapion one and Star Requiem the other, they just win the game. There's not really anything you can do about it. We did see the Heroes Medal come out a little bit as a tech, right? So yeah. Some people are kind of on that. I know that's a card you played in Mew in the past, right? So
yeah, it doesn't stop Star Requiem though. Star Requiem still draws three.
Yeah, it's
got to
be the early option. Yeah, right? it's got to be the first Mew VMAX. The one that they're going to Drapion has to have the medal.
Yeah, yeah. So it gives you like some. Yeah, you have to find it early. But Mew's pretty good at that. They got the crayons, right? They're pretty good at finding cards when they need
you can
to. So
anything, bro.
Literally, could put a Skyla in there even plus one of any item card.
I'm not talking.
You can find Cross Switcher or Tablet. Maybe that could be the next. You can find Cross Switcher, find Tablet, can find your Heroes Medal or Parasol. Parasol is also like a reasonable option because if you Heroes Medal a Mew, they could still KO it with Giratina with the 280. But if you Parasol it, they can't 280 it. Oh, I guess they can still drape you on you though. Yeah, never mind. It doesn't work. Like I thought. Never mind. They can still. Yeah, they have the answers. Yeah, Heroes Medal has to be the way. You have to find it like literally turn two though.
Two Heroes Medal.
That was the thing. I know James Cox was the one who was running that in like three or four events in a row. It was like a regional and SP. I don't know. Yeah, he was rocking that in the Mew for a little while. The double Heroes Medal to deal with the Arceus baby dark stuff a while back.
The Moltres and all.
Yeah.
So we'll see. Yeah, I think I think Mew could go on an uptick for sure. Yeah. I mean, it's definitely shown its consistency. I mean, JW and Mahone back-to-back weekends had, or not back-to-back weekends, back-to-back tournaments had super good results, obviously. There was a player on the outside looking in ninth place. So, I mean, it's just opponent's resistance away from being in top cut. So Mew is definitely still very strong, even with Drapion running around. And then maybe if players look at this top cut and see less Mew, maybe they start to think, okay, can I cut the Drapion from my deck if there's less Mew? And then it becomes the whole thing of like, okay, less Drapion, now Mew's way better. And yeah, the meta within the meta, right?
Yeah, it's like we're not quite at the Decidueye cycle. I don't know if we'll get there. I don't know if we'll enter the Decidueye cycle, but we might. And we even saw like Caleb Rogerson cut the Drapion from the Palkia. Didn't run the Drapion in the Palkia, so wasn't too afraid. And you don't really need it in Palkia, to be honest, as well. It is nice, and it kind of gives you, I feel like, almost an auto win. I don't know how Mew could ever handle a Palkia deck with a Drapion. That feels abysmal to go up against. I think Cal probably won a ridiculous amount of games against Mew with the Drapion in Peoria. But yeah, definitely not necessary for that deck. So yeah, I think Mew is definitely the deck to, like, that's like the, not the gamble deck, but like definitely always going to be a really solid play. It's just like, how many people are going to show up with Drapion on the day?
Well, let's talk about the results of the tournament now. We've talked about the meta. Now let's talk about what actually ended up happening at the event. And I would say two more unexpected decks in the finals of the event. Of course, the tournament was won by Hale Ulbernulty. It's a player that many of the people who started playing over the last couple of years probably don't recognize Hale's name, but yeah. Hale's a very, very good player. You know, most of the people who've been around for a while definitely know who Hale is. He's gotten second place at two regionals over the last few years, and he actually did win a regionals back in 2013. So this is his second regionals win, and he was able to do it with the Arceus Gudra.
Yeah, Arceus Gudra in the finals. And I really liked the list. I really liked the chorus. That's the thing that stood out to me the most. I didn't know. No one mentioned to me because I had two of my other teammates play against Hale throughout the day. And no one mentioned to me that he was playing chorus. It wasn't a huge surprise when I saw it, and it kind of made sense. But he played. I was like, wait, what? There's chorus in here. Why did no one mention this to me? It didn't really change anything, but I just thought that'd be something that maybe one of them would have mentioned to me. Maybe they just thought it was default. But it's really good in decks like Gudra, where you don't have a draw engine built into the deck. So it naturally thins your deck without sacrificing resources as consistently as something like Research. Hale still ran the one Research, but then played four Cultures Experiment. Because you look at the top five, you take two, you lost on the other two. So you take the good cards or the better cards. Sometimes you do have to get rid of good cards on a Colrus. So you take the better cards, yes. Lost on two of them. So when you start getting Marnied and Roxanne, which is kind of sometimes the bane of some of these decks where you don't have like a built-in draw engine like a B-Barrel or a Shady Dealings and Inteleon to work with, you're going to draw dead less often off of those Marnies and Roxannes as the game continues because your deck is so thinned out because of the Colrus Experiment. So I thought that was like a a great way to play the deck, I think.
Absolutely. I mean, if we look at this deck, the way that it operates in game plan, and you can see this in pretty much all of Hale's games, is you want to go with one Arceus V-Star and two Gudras. Sometimes he would go for the second Arceus, but it's usually one Arceus, two Gudras. But you play a 4-2 Arceus line, and then you play a ton of search cards still, the Ultra Balls, the Evolution Incense, the four Quick Balls, all of these things. But once you are established and have your Pokemon in play, you don't need the extra Arceus V. You don't need the extra Ultra Balls and stuff. So these become kind of useless cards that clunk up your deck for Roxanne's and Marnie's in the late game, and Corvus's Experience can remove them from your deck entirely.
Yeah, get rid of them. Don't have to ever see them again. You draw into your Hyper Potions more consistently off Marnie's. You draw into your Double Turbos.
I mean, and just seeing kind of five cards off the top. I mean, who we've always joked about, like, you know, how we've got cards like Trevor, Tierno, whatever, draw three cards. And they've like always flirted with giving us a draw four card, but we've never gotten it. We've always gotten like bad ways to draw four cards off the top.
Yeah.
And I think Robin wrote an article or made a post once about why draw four in Pokemon would just be absolutely broken. Or why it would be maybe just a little bit too high of power level and why they haven't given us that quite yet. Corvus's Experiment is kind of a pseudo draw five, right? I mean, you do have the downside of lost zoning stuff, but just seeing five cards off the top and not having to lose things that you've already accrued in your hand is very strong.
Yeah, let's do kind of build up the one decent draw four we've had, which only worked in the tag team Gardevoir deck, was that one where if you're tag team, if you're active as a tag, if you're active as a tag team, you draw four. It just allows you to kind of like almost like build on your hand and also kind of craft your hand and not lose the potential of the cards you currently have to combo with cards you could get, right? Bro, every time you play a Marnie, you get like a random four.
Wonder if he could have played the Icecon. Is that what its name is?
What does it do?
It's draw two cards. If your active Pokemon has Hisuian in its name, draw two more. Obviously not great when you have Arceus in your active, right? But that would be maybe the problem. Maybe it's like a
one of. Yeah, maybe it's like a one of for like the mid-late game. Just an extra draw supporter to not have to discard your hand. But yeah, that's what Corvus does so well. Like you get to hold on to your Hyper Potion or your Double Turbo and then use Corvus and then you go get the Hyper Potion or the Double Turbo and then you can actually use Hyper Potion in your turn. You just kind of build up your hand or allow yourself to combo cards with the current cards in your hand with the cards you draw instead of just like, you know, playing Marnie and hoping to get the two cards you need. Now you get to keep one of them in combo with the future stuff you get off of course and start to build up towards bigger plays. So
Art Gudra was a deck that we talked about last week, and I mean similarly to Arceus Duraludon, it feels like a deck that most of the top players, we talk about this a lot, like the opinions of the top players, but it's just a deck that most of them want to stay away from because they feel like it's super linear and there's ways to play around the strategies, right? And when you play against better players, they're going to know how to, you know, kind of get around the cheesy, tanky healing that your deck is trying to employ. So what about the meta in Salt Lake City was right for Hale to be able to make such a deep run?
So I think Reggie's definitely played a part. I think that definitely boosted Hale's chance to win. But so I haven't played any games with Gudra Arceus. Zero games. Because the last couple, I haven't streamed in like 4 weeks. It's been a while. A lot of traveling, a little bit of being sick. I'm finally going to get back to all that stuff this week. I'm like excited to stream. I haven't streamed in so long. I'm like excited to do it. So excited to get back into that. And I'll actually probably play some games with Arceus Gudra. But if those matchups are like fine, then I actually think the deck is just pretty good. So, like, my opinion, I don't really have a strong opinion of the deck because I never played it. And there was a couple decks that I wanted to try, ideally test more going into Peoria and this tournament, which was Arceus Gudra and then Arceus B-Barrel Marnie Path plus X, which we did see, you know, the Flying Pikachu get second. I just had played zero games with these decks in format, these Arceus decks, and I was like, I don't know how good they are. I don't know what they beat. I don't know what they lose to. And yeah, so I was like, I wish I'd had time to play with those decks, but I haven't been streaming or making content the last couple of weeks. I've just been busy with traveling, not really playing that much Pokemon, to be honest. So I had no clue. But yeah, if you can handle like the Tina with this, if this list can like handle Tina and the other stuff, then like the deck is just good. I do agree with you, though. It does seem like, you know, top players tend to try and stray away from these decks. But, you know, if I had played it and I felt like it had just the highest win percentage in the meta, I would have played this what's it called as well? I would have played this for Salt Lake City as well, but I was having no testing with it. Reggie seemed like the better play to me, but I mean, yeah, I just, that's where I'm at with Gudra. I don't know if you've played anything with it.
Not very much, no. But that was something Hale as well talked about, I think, in one of his winner's interviews. He was interviewed. Hale was on the stream a lot this past weekend. He got streamed in day one and in day two and then top four and final. So he had four of his matches streamed. So there's plenty of Gudra content out there if you want to go watch any of those games. But in one of his winner's interviews, I believe one of the things he talked about was, like, you know, how this was a deck that a lot of people just didn't respect as a great deck. Most players kind of just naturally stayed away from it, but he kind of recognized the power level of it, and that's what led to him wanting to go with it. We'll talk about the Pikachu deck next that James Thiel played. But before we get into the deck, something that I think is really cool that we should mention as well. Whenever we're collecting player accomplishments and stuff like that to put up on the stream for Top Cut players, James, the only accomplishment that James had to put up on the screen was a first place win at a league challenge in 2018. So that is just to say to anyone listening who maybe feels like intimidated about like going to an 800 plus person tournament like Salt Lake City was, because you don't feel experienced or, like, you know, worried about any of that type of stuff. I mean, James, this was his first regionals day two. I talked to him a little bit after the finals. First regionals day two, and he ends up getting second place. And with a deck that I think not really anyone was expecting to see very much of at this tournament, the Arceus V-Star Flying Pikachu.
Yeah, actually, to kind of like before we talk about the Arceus Flying Pikachu, to kind of talk about that in general, I actually had this conversation with someone recently about, like, you know, nerves going to your first tournament or going to a big tournament. And I was like, I almost like never had that experience, because when I first started playing, I just loved playing Pokemon. I didn't care about like consistently doing well or winning. And I won the first regionals I played in Masters. I won. Like, I won my first regionals in Masters, right? But if I didn't do well, I wouldn't have cared. It's really weird the way the game is. And I'm not trying to just brag, right? It's just like,
I'll say my first regionals, I went like 3-5 or 3-4 or something. Like, I did really bad at my first regionals, but in the same spot as Azul, I just loved playing Pokemon and wanted to go play. So that, I think, like, aside from the competition, go for the Pokemon TCG experience, right?
Yeah, to kind of put that in perspective, that's what I wanted to kind of put it in perspective, is like, because I feel like back then, and the biggest thing from like when I thought about it, like, and as I played throughout all the years leading up to where I am now, you know, 10, 11 years later, I never really had that experience of showing up to it. I can't think of a point in when I played Pokemon, because I kind of naturally progressed with the growth of the game to the point where I show up to a regional and I was like, oh, this tournament's going to be too big. How do I pick a deck? What do I do? Like, all these kind of things that people come to me with questions about, because I kind of grew as the game developed that kind of atmosphere or environment, where now when people like are coming to these Pokemon tournaments, they're worried about getting championship points and getting their invite. What deck do they play? And I feel like so many less people are just showing up to just kind of bring a Pokemon deck they really enjoy playing. And I always talk about trying to play like the optimal deck and that kind of stuff, but like I feel like so many less people just kind of show up just to play Pokemon with their favorite deck and aren't worried about getting championship points or placing well. There's such a bigger pressure on everyone in Pokemon just to like try and do well or try and get your invite or try and at least place to get championship points, which is like good, right? Like the competition is good and having a goal is good, but I feel like it puts a lot of people in a bad mental space throughout a tournament or going into a tournament overall. Like when I compare it back to my first regional in Masters, where it was just like I just showed up with my favorite deck and played Pokemon, right? I wasn't thinking about my invite or placing well or doing this or doing that. I just showed up, had fun with my friends, and played Pokemon, right? Like it feels like the game is developed and it all of a sudden has this atmosphere where everyone is like worried about all these other little things. Yeah, like everything's gotten way more hyper competitive, which is like not a bad thing, but I also feel like it does detract from kind of the overall enjoyment of the game a little bit. As a whole,
I do think there are still tons of people every single tournament who just show up because they love Pokemon and want to play Pokemon, right? People who live around the area where these tournaments are there. We just see and talk about it a lot less because, you know, these are the players who are just hanging out. You know, they lost in the early rounds, their records, they can't make day two, but they're still playing it out in round 6, 7, 8 because they enjoy the game and just love playing Pokemon. We don't talk about that on Twitter. We don't talk about that on the official broadcast, but there's just still tons of people out there in the field playing Pokemon. So definitely don't be discouraged by any of those things. And you never know. Your first day two could lead to your first top eight, could lead to a second place finish, which is what happened for James Thiel. And now we can move on and talk about the Arceus Flying P. So, Azul, obviously, you are probably one of the more experienced players with this deck. You did win the North American International Championships with Arceus Flying P, with the Bibarel, though this list is a bit different. The whole new set, the whole new meta. Of course, it's got the four Marnies, three Paths to the Peak, one Collapse Stadium, the double Drapion V, the Espeon VMAX as well. This really does feel like kind of just an anti-meta Arceus deck.
Yeah, definitely like full anti-meta. The double Drapion is something like, you know, you just kind of lock up your Mew matchup now. You got the Flying Pikachus for the Palkia, of course. And then you got the Espeon, the 1-1 Espeon VMAX with the Solar Revelation ability. Prevent all effective attacks from your opponent's Pokemon. Don't you all of your Pokemon have any energy attached to them? So, of course, once you use your a Trinity... Oh, it's all Pokemon, too. It's not just V Pokemon, right? Yes, so, yeah, once you use Trinity Nova, you're just putting like an energy on each of your V Pokemon. And then if you're up against like a Lost Zone deck with Sableye, you attach an energy for turn to your B barrel to protect that from Sableye. And then your board is Sableye proof. Your board is Tina Star Requiem proof. Flying Pikachus are 1-KO in Palkias. Drapions are 1-KO in Mew V Maxes. And with Punkaboo in there, even when Mew hits you with that late game Roxanne Path, like if you just find your Punkaboo, you're just good to go. Second Drapion, knock out their second Mew. So super anti-meta deck. I think overall, like when you compare this to the other builds of Flying Pikachu that we've seen take down events, like me at NAIC or Andre at Worlds, the Palkia matchup is definitely going to be a little bit worse. A lot more junk in here. I think consistency is key against Palkia. Still got the path, pretty heavy path count in three and the four Marnie. So you still have that solid game plan, plus the Flying Pikachu against Palkia. So it's not going to be a terrible Palkia matchup by any chance, but it's going to be closer for sure than like the other builds. But I think, yeah, I mean, as long as like this once again, like I don't have too strong of an opinion on this deck because I see the Drapions, I see the Flying Pikachu, but like I said, I didn't really test many Arceus decks going into these last two tournaments, didn't have the time, but it seems like the Espeon's enough to get through the Lost Zone decks. And that's my big question mark. Is that enough? But it seems like it is, right?
I think Espeon was hyped up a little bit pre-Peoria, but didn't really get talked about afterwards because Tord won with Lost Box or the Sableye Charizard deck with four Path, right? And obviously Path shuts off Espeon's ability, but it is still very good against Giratina, and Giratina ended up being the most played deck. So yeah, I mean, this is the type of deck that if you just draw well with your counters and you're going to have some clunky cards in every single matchup, right? Like you're not really wanting to utilize your Espeon stuff against Mew VMAX. So that's just going to be kind of floating around in the deck while you're trying to find your Drapion pieces. You're not really going to want Flying Pikachu in a lot of instances unless you're playing against the Palkia or Reggie. So they're just going to be, once again, floating around, stuck in the deck, trying to... get set up and find whatever combo you're wanting to get to. One thing about this deck for James, though, that I do like as well is he's got the powerful colorless energy in here as opposed to Glaring Zigzagoon, which is something that a lot of people have been playing. The bench space for this deck definitely gets really filled up super fast with the Lumineon and Crobat as well. And that was something that actually kind of was bad for James in the finals. In game one especially, his bench just got really kind of clogged up. And that's ultimately why he ended up losing the game, is because there wasn't a space for him to have another attacker to go into after whatever he had in the active was going to go down. So, but all that to say, I like the powerful colorless energy because... anytime you go first and attach a double turbo energy, you can threaten a turn two KO on a Pokemon V, be it a Palkia, an Arceus, a Mew, a Genesect, a Giratina V, whatever it is. If you just get the double turbo energy down on turn one, you can then go Starbirth and try to find the combination of Choice Belt, Boss, and Powerful Colorless Energy to take that knockout. Yep. And if you can do that with Arceus, I mean, and I'm sure you experienced this playing Arceus Bibarel decks in the past as well, if you can just take that first quick KO, you're going to get so far ahead in the game on turn two right away.
Yeah, and then, like, especially with your, you know, something like if you're up against a Palkia deck and then you just let up a Flying Pikachu, the game is basically over as long as they can't KO the Flying Pikachu next turn. Because if they just come up and punch an Arceus, the Flying Pikachu comes up, takes out that Palkia, and the game just kind of snowballs from there. So yeah, it's a very powerful option. We've seen it in the past with Zigzagoon, but yeah, with bench space involved, it's a little bit awkward. And so like you have like those five outs to draw. Like if you draw into the double turbo or the powerful, in the first two turns of the game, to be honest, you could attach, you know, the powerful energy first, but then if you just find, then you can find the double turbo, the Choice Belt Boss, right? So you have like a lot of outs to actually set up the the combo in those first two turns. I'm not sure I love it. I never was a huge fan of Zigzagoon Choice Belt in general.
Oh, I always loved it.
It's definitely a lot cooler with the powerful energy. And the powerful and the choice belt beside the powerful energy like isn't too big of a hindrance to you. It's really like, is the choice belt worth it? I feel like is the bigger thing. But sure, it is pretty good on Arceus past that combo, right? Because even if you put it on your next Arceus that has three basic energy, then that one can KO a V and so on like that. And even if you go, the choice belt still has gained a little bit of value because up against Zorark, Zorark only has 210 HP. So just DTE plus choice belt knocks out Zorarks. And that's a matchup where you really need to be aggressive if you're the Arceus player, because that's like a bad matchup. So you and really need to kind of stick it
forget,
to him.
Can't forget the choice belt, Drapion, energy, boom, knock out the Palkia for one. Hey, listen.
That's true. The dynamic tail after the keep calling. Got to be careful for it. And I'm sure there's other, like, there's always little scenarios where it'll be, like, good for a max balloon.
I mean, as on the Espeon as an attacker as well, like, adding some extra damage there. I mean, Espeon is a pretty solid attacker, which we saw James try to lean on a little bit in the finals match, but Hale obviously knew what the Espeon did and was playing around it, putting not enough energy in play to where it was ever going to be a threat. And that was really unfortunate that we didn't get a great showing from this deck on the stream, just because this is an anti-meta deck, right? It's going to do really, at least have a better shot against something like the Palkia. It's going to do fine against the Giratina. It's going to do great against Reggie with the Flying Pikachu, obviously, as well. But James not really having a great answer for the Hisuian Goodra.
Yeah, that feels, yeah, almost, you don't, you just don't beat it, I don't think. I don't think there's any way to beat Goodra. You're like three hit KOing them, and if you just don't have to use Starbirth or find a Hyper Potion, the game just gets so far out of control. The other card that was super cool in this list, and I think actually should just become the norm for these Arceus decks, is Volo. Super strong in this deck, because it allows you to be more aggressive with setting up different attackers. But even once you put that VMAX in play and attack with it for turn, whether it be the Espeon or the Flying Pikachu, and I actually think, to be honest, after I saw the Volo, I was like, there should probably be two Volo in here. I think Volo is super sick in this deck. There's the Collapse Stadium, so yeah, I guess that it does kind of double as a Volo. And once that gets you far enough ahead, it's fine for you to like bump your own path in certain matchups for sure as well. So, but I could see like two Volo and a Collapse Stadium, to be honest. Like, that's like a super strong combo. Just set up a bunch of attackers with Arceus and start to kind of switch between them, Volo them out of play, Collapse Stadium them out of play. And you shouldn't really run out of attackers, I don't feel like. Because you could even get to the point where Drapion could attack as well. But yeah. Just kind of cycle through your attackers and heal them out of play with the Collapse and the Volo. So everything's a great attacker now with Volo. Because with Charon's Care, you wouldn't really want to set up like your VMAXs, like the Pikachu VMAXs in a lot of matchups, because it would be giving up three prizes on a two-hit KO usually. So you're like, I don't really want to set this thing up just for it to get two hit. But now with Volo, you can send up Pikachu for a turn, let it hit, let it take a hit, retreat it, attack with Arceus, and in the turn you Volo it away or Collapse it away. And then, yeah, there's not that liability on the board anymore. So I think that was actually super cool addition.
So looking at the rest of the top eight, obviously we had the four Reggies, yourself, Grant, and Caleb, all being on the same 60, and then Drew Kennett also playing Reggie. A couple different cards in here. He was playing things like Bruno. He had the boss's orders as well. But this was cool to see as well, because Drew has had a pretty stellar last couple of tournaments. Yeah. Of course, he did get top eight in Baltimore just about a month ago, and then he did win Salt Lake City Regionals in the last season. So had a chance to defend his title. He did take a game off of Hale in top eight, but ultimately Goodra was just a little too sticky for Drew to overcome.
Yeah, that's a pretty tough one. Even with the bad Drago, it's still a really, really tough matchup no matter what.
The other two decks in top eight, Nick Moffitt getting top four, which, funny enough, Nick also got top four at the last Salt Lake City. So it's a pretty good place for Nick Moffitt, I guess. A couple of top four finishes. He was playing the Giratina Comfy, and then Caleb Rogerson getting eighth place with the Palkia Inteleon. And, you know, Caleb also having a good time in Salt Lake City. This is his first top eight as a master. He's a first-year Masters Division player, but he did win the Salt Lake City Regional Championships last season, though that was in the Seniors Division. So lots of really cool stories, honestly, out of this top eight. And the bracket was honestly a pretty good-looking one as well. I mean, Grant versus Azul is a great matchup, obviously. Two of the best players in the modern era of the game. Caleb Gettemer, multiple time regional champion. You know, the James Steele story is really cool. You know, winning a league challenge into making second place and then Hale Oberholtzer versus Andrew Kinnett and Caleb Rutherford versus Nick Moffitt. So I did really quickly before we move on, want to touch on why we chose to stream the match we streamed, because I did see a couple of comments about that. I think a lot of people would just look at the names of this top cut and immediately say, why would we not stream Grant versus Azul? And I think that is a totally fair thing to say. And obviously when we're looking at player names, I think that is the match that would have made the most sense to see up on the screen. But the reason that we didn't go with this match for top eight is because it was the Reggie Mirror. And even though there's things you can do, so much of it just comes down to who gets the first attack, right?
And especially now with Gift Energy, it's just like a huge snowball.
So, I mean, you as being one of these two players, right? I mean, what is your kind of thoughts on that? Like, even though that match, from what you described earlier, sounds like it ended up being pretty interesting. You did win 2-0, but just the the Reggie Mirror as a feature game, like, is there much interesting going on that generally people would be able to watch and grasp?
I mean, the game one was kind of interesting, but like, there's not. Yeah, I predicted you guys to pick Caleb versus Moffitt. That made the most sense because there's two of the unique decks in cut. So, you know, this is the only chance you'll get to stream one of them for sure. And then you could have predicted the Flying Pikachu to beat Caleb, which means you have a chance to stream Flying Pikachu later on, potentially. And you knew there was a Reggie coming out of the other side, so Reggie was going to be on stream at some point anyway. So it is the logical to me, and it wouldn't have been very exciting. We would have just been sitting there attacking, and then the other person attacks, and whoever attacks first generally wins, although in game one would have been exciting because I prized Double Rock and had to find my heavy ball. And Grant got, you know, the first attack off, but then whiffed on the following turn. But then from there, it was just back and forth. Now I was ahead by one prize card. So,
sure. Yeah,
definitely, I think, a good call in the end.
Yeah, for sure. And, I mean, yeah, Hale versus Drew. Hale is just so heavily favored. Drew did find a way to get a game, but Hale is just going to win. When it comes to a best of three, like, even though Drew can steal a game, it's just going to be so hard for Hale to ever lose a best of three. Once again, and Caleb going up against James with the Flying Pikachu, y'all's list not having the boss's orders, we felt like there was just very little chance for Caleb in that one, and he did end up losing 0-2. James moving on, of course. And then Caleb versus Nick ended up being a pretty decent game. Though what ended up happening, though, is because what we typically do is we pick from one side of the bracket and then for top eight, and then we go to the other side of the bracket for top four. So it kind of meant inevitably we were going to have to stream Reggie versus Gudra. So I guess maybe hindsight looking at that, we could have gone Grant versus Azul and then gone to the other side of the bracket, but we had seen Reggie so much on the stream. We had not seen very much of the Giratina decks. We did want to feature it. And then, of course, there's the story with Nick getting top four at the last Salt Lake City, Caleb winning the last Salt Lake City. You obviously are going for your sixth regionals win. Grant is probably one of the best players who hasn't won a regionals. So there's plenty of stories there as well. I mean, you can make a story for like all of the top eight matches, honestly. But that's why we ended up choosing what we chose. So I think regardless of which way we went, there would be people hoping that we had picked differently. It's just kind of the curse of having to pick a stream game, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah, there was no winning in that one, I don't think. I think it was correct the way you went about it. It would have been more exciting if Drew had, you know, been able to beat Hale, and then it would have been me against Drew in top four. That would have been like probably the most exciting, conclusion maybe potentially. But it was going to be hard to do that. And then you guys got to watch me, which, to be honest, I wouldn't have held it against you guys either if you just didn't stream me and Hale and then instead just put on Nick again against James. That probably would have been a way more exciting match to stream. It would have been fine. I was surprised.
And maybe we should have.
I was going on stream. Yeah, it was pretty bad.
I mean, there's no rule that says we have to go to the other side of the bracket. It's just kind of what we normally do, so we don't theoretically
sense.
Like, the risk in streaming the same side of the bracket would be that we might stream the same person three games in a row, which we don't necessarily want to do. It wouldn't be the worst thing, I guess, but there's always so many decisions, and, you know, we're always trying to improve with the streams. There's definitely been a lot of discourse on Twitter about the stream the last few days, which is fair. You know, I'd love for people to provide their feedback, and I do see it, obviously, so it's all good and fine. But we'll move on from Salt Lake results. We'll talk a little bit about some of these judging issues that kind of came up at the tournament. Let's try to go pretty quickly through this, though. And this was brought up by Caleb Rogerson on Twitter, who, of course, was one of the top eight competitors, posting that in round 15 of the Salt Lake City Regionals, I had the head judge rule that Aurora Energy can be kept on Reggie Alecki after a Terra Spark as long as it has two Speed Lightning Energies attached to it to fulfill the cost. According to this ruling with the Galarian Darmanitan, this should not be the case. So, of course, Reggie Alecki's Terra Spark, it says discard all lightning energy from this Pokemon. So if you have two-speed lightning and an Aurora energy, the ruling that came from the judge was that you could choose to keep the Aurora energy. But if you read the print of Aurora energy, and this does get confusing, and I even saw people in the replies of this tweet not understanding how this works. And I think it is understandable that they don't understand it. It is a little confusing because Aurora Energy says as long as this card is attached to a Pokemon, it provides every type of energy, but only provides one energy at a time. So reading that, you might think, okay, so it can provide one lightning energy, or it can provide one fire energy, or one darkness energy, or one whatever energy. But that's not the case. It provides just one energy, but it is one energy that is at the same time all of the types. You don't get to like pick what energy type it is. So
yeah,
in combination with the Terra Spark of Reggie Alecki, you would have to discard the Aurora energy. And it's a little, you know, I think a lot of people were a little annoyed to see that this is a ruling that's coming in round 15 of our regionals. And in Caleb's replies as well, it does sound a little shaky as far as what happened with the head judge, as far as the head judge never came over to the table, right? It was a floor judge. They went and conferred with someone else and then came back. And I think Caleb just assumed it was the head judge, or maybe was told it was the head judge. Don't know exactly what ended up happening here, but I think the main thing that we wanted to talk about out of this is that if you are confident in how something is supposed to work, and that maybe you have gotten an incorrect ruling from a judge, or you just want confirmation, you as a player always have a right to speak to the head judge.
Yeah, you can always call over the head judge. We've talked about this, I don't know, last week, 2 weeks ago, whenever. Just call over the head judge. If you think your opponent's wrong, if you think the ruling's wrong, call over the head judge, get it squared away. Sometimes you will be wrong, but usually I feel like in these scenarios, if you're that confident that you think, like, usually the players know it's for the most part, right? Usually the players just kind of know the correct ruling. I guess that's not always true, because the other player thinks it gets ruled the other way. But yeah, call over head judge if you think you're right, I guess is the moral of the story. Is call over head judge if you think you're right. I think we always kind of say this. I definitely say this. I think Chip usually agrees with me. So Chip, if you disagree, feel free. But remember, judges in Pokemon, they're not, once again, like I say this all the time, there's like not like a ridiculous amount of judges who are vying for these spots, I feel like, to judge these tournaments. They are volunteers. They are not being, you know, paid like an hour, like even minimum wage to be there at these events doing the jobs that someone has to do, right? For these events to run, we need the staff to be there. If they were being paid, you know, minimum wage, whatever it might be, to run these, to judge these events, and I think it'd be fair for us to be a lot more upset when rulings like this get, out of place. And I could be wrong on the how many people are trying to judge the events. And if that is the case, I actually saw Will Post make a tweet this morning or the other day, which was basically like, if you're going to judge events, you should be going out of your way to familiarize yourself with the game, so that you can be, you know, perform the job of being a judge better, right? But if we only had judges who like play the game a lot be judges at events, how many would we have enough judges for the events? So that'd be my question. I don't know how many people apply for these events to be judges. My assumption would be not enough to the point where we could get rid of everyone and only get people who are like, you know, people who play the game consistently and want the spot. So I don't know, we need someone there.
And I do agree with you and understand and like am sympathetic to the fact that judges are not, you know, paid nearly as much as they probably should be. But the issue is, and most of the time judges are being paid via like product, right? They get booster boxes or whatever it is, and staff cards, staff playmats and stuff like that. That's like usually what the compensation looks like for these tournaments. It does vary by tournament organizer, though, we do have to say. But I think that the kind of issue here is that these, like, even though these judges aren't being paid, the rulings that they are making directly is influencing so much. Championship points, prize money, stipends, travel awards, worlds, invites. Like, these rulings have ripple effect impacts that are much bigger than, you know, what they're being paid for, right?
Yeah, yeah. But I still think it still comes back around to the point where if we remove the judges, if no one wants to judge all of a sudden because it is a volunteer position, then the events don't happen.
Of course.
And then there's no stipends or championship points to play for at all, right? So I think if compensation is leveled to the point where you want to hold the judges, I think it's fair to hold the judges to the higher standard if enough judges exist that hold themselves to a higher standard to try and be better judges that would replace the judges who don't. But because we don't know if there's that many judges who would replace the judges who are doing a worse job and replace them with judges who would do a better job, we kind of just have to be like, until they're compensated to the point where we can hold them to a higher standard, it's hard to actually hold them to a higher standard, right? Because we just don't know. I just don't know how many applications these TOs get for the judging position. If they get a lot, then I think that maybe we should, the thing to look at would be, we can put it on the TOs to be like, you should be doing a better job of filtering out who is judging your events, right? If they're getting, you know, 200-300% of the applications they would need to fill the spots, right? Like, if they need 100 judges and they get 300 applications, maybe we need to put on the TOs to do a better process of filtering out who gets to come to judge the events and who doesn't, right? And then give the priority to the people who are putting the extra effort. But if there's 112 people applying for 100 spots, you kind of got to take what you get, right? And then they're being compensated reasonably, it's hard for me to see why it's fair for us to hold them to a higher standard, right? Because at the end of the day, they're volunteering for a job that has to be done for us to be able to participate in these events. We just don't know all the information yet. So I don't really want to pick one side of the fight on this one too heavily.
Yeah. So we'll move on from that a little bit more about something sort of similar, more about penalties as opposed to judging. So this is a issue that came up on the stream, and I saw this on Twitter today. This is a tweet from Evan Smith talking about the rules that need to be changed. So basically what this tweet longer is referencing is a stream match where a player named Ryan Harris used Comfy flower selecting after a deck search. So the player had searched the deck through a quick ball, something like that. After a deck search, they use flower selecting. They're supposed to see the top two cards, and they accidentally saw the third card of the deck. And because a third card was revealed, an extra card was seen, a two prize penalty was awarded. Now, this is a very minor mistake, and obviously I would say a mistake as well, because realistically there's no advantage that is going to be gained from seeing that other card whenever you have to make a decision based off of the two regardless, and you already know what you have access to in your deck because your deck has just been searched, right? And so a two prize penalty was given to Ryan, and that instantly changed the outcome of the game. So pretty much what this is saying is that the ruling in this spot is just too harsh for what the penalty was. And this is actually kind of similar to what happened to you in your top four match. You got a two prize penalty because your opponent played Roxanne. You drew two cards, accidentally saw the third card as well, or started to draw extra cards.
Yeah. I thought I got Marty. I was going to draw four. I was literally going to draw four.
It's a good thing they stopped me at three because the fourth was... So Azul accidentally drew extra cards. I mean, these are just things that happen, right? Playing with real cards. We're not playing on PTCGO. It doesn't do it for you. You have to draw the cards physically yourself. You saw the extra card. You got given a two prize penalty, which led to your opponent instantly winning the game because they only had two prize cards left when it wasn't going to impact anything at all because it wasn't even your turn. You saw the two cards, and before anything else happened, your opponent was going to attack into your Reggie Drago that had a gift energy on it. So you were going to draw that card anyway before you even had to promote anything. So it was literally going to have no impact on the game whatsoever, but a two prize penalty was still given.
Yeah, and I would see the card before I even had to choose what I would send up as well. Like, I would gain zero advantage. And to be honest, I could have probably, at that point, I didn't care because there was no way for me to win. there was one way for me to win, but I checked my deck after the two prize penalty and I would have whiffed the play anyway. So there was no chance for me to actually win the game. Because it was, I needed to draw like Reggie Rock off the gift energy with Yelhorn and Twin Energy, and the Rock was like the 9th or 10th card, so I would have whiffed the play anyways. But I bring it up all the time when we talk about penalties and stuff, right? I'm always like, I don't think seeing an extra card should be a prize penalty, especially in situations like that, like my situation where like we can look at the board state, and then hopefully if my opponent is like being honest about their situation, they'd be like, yeah, they're not gaining any advantage here. If they agree with me on that, which, you know, what is the actual situation? There's zero advantage for me to gain. If I say that my opponent agrees, the judge can see why that's true. I should get a warning. And if I do it again, even in a similar scenario, then I should get a 2-prize penalty, right? But on that first one, I feel like, yeah, in those kind of situations, I don't think I should get a 2-prize penalty. I didn't argue it because I just was like, I don't think it cares. I'm going to lose any. I don't really care. I'm going to lose anyways. Let's go ahead to the next game. So I didn't call over the head judge. I didn't request the head judge. I didn't argue with, I believe it was, I don't remember who the judge was at the table. I didn't argue with them at all. I was like, yeah, whatever. I don't really care. But I do think it is too harsh of a penalty in general. And I think there should be at least a build up to it where like, if you like the first time you buy XCC an extra card, I think it's fine. Like it would be fine. Like I never call over. I had multiple players throughout the run, my tournament run here at Salt Lake City, who saw an extra card, whether it be drawing an extra card for turns, they played a Marnie research, drew an extra card, and I always just told them just put it back on top of that because I don't care. I feel like it's like a ridiculous advantage to be gained from just like a very common human error. And the other thing I like to tie to that is in Pokemon regional tournaments, it's not like this is just the MLB of the Pokemon TCG tournaments. It's T-ball to MLB. This is some players who it's their first tournament. Some player picked up their deck to play in their first tournament going into regionals because they've only played on PDTGO up to this point. They don't know how to shuffle. The amount of people I've played against since the games come back who are just really bad at shuffling is so high. It's insane. Like, people should not be getting prize penalties for accidentally drawing an extra card. Maybe if they do it 2-3 times throughout a tournament. You know, you call over a judge, they give them the warning, they write them up. Okay, saw an extra card once, saw an extra card twice. Okay, saw an extra card third time. That's a double prize penalty. Fourth time, quad prize penalty. Fifth time, game loss, sixth time, match loss, whatever, you know, however you want to scale it. But I don't think the first time you actually see an extra card, it should lead to the double prize penalty.
So I remember back in like 2016, 2017, this being a huge issue because there was a huge streak of players accidentally drawing extra cards on stream and it would get caught like turns later. They would have to rewind it and it became a huge mess and the result was a warning. Right. That was like what the result of it was. And so I think that it almost feels like they escalated it sometime in the 2017-2018 timeframe when the rules kind of got a little bit of an update or the penalty guidelines got a little bit of an update. It
was 2015-2016, I think.
No, it was definitely in like the 2018 timeframe. It's like,
oh, no, you are right. You are right. Yeah.
Yeah, so is when it got changed from recommended penalty warning to recommended penalty 2-prize penalty. And I mean, that's a huge jump, and it is easily one of the most common. Like, I mean, I bet if they had the stat of penalties given at regional championships, like, it's probably 90% extra card seen 2-prize penalty. Like, it has to be. It just happens so often. It definitely feels, I mean, it's something that players, I mean, sometimes it happens inadvertently because players are playing too quickly. They need to just kind of like slow down. But at the same time, players are trying to play quickly to finish their games within the best of 350 minute parameters that we have. So
yeah,
a little bit of a mess. Like I would like to see this de-escalated or at least allow it to the point where judges can use their discretion to escalate or de-escalate as they see fit.
Yeah.
Like there's a difference between someone, I don't know, using concealed cards for a second time on accident and seeing 2 more cards. There's a difference between that and then like 2 cards hitting their hand and someone who is not even their turn accidentally seeing an extra card because they thought they got Roxanne or Marnied versus being Roxanne, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think you could be situational with it. And then also just kind of, I think it should be able to be escalate. Like, I think the baseline should be a warning and then kind of scale it with how many times a judge
how
is called over for
it is
to, yeah, for a specific player. Then it should escalate to eventually being, you know, prize penalties, game losses, whatever, right? If it's their 7th time on the day, there should probably be more than a warning, right? But I also think they should be able to escalate. Like, even if it's their first time, if it's like, well, because of the board state, you seeing that extra card gives you so much information on what to do on your next turn. We have to escalate this to a double prize penalty, right? I think that would be fair. But if it's kind of more of a neutral position, you play a research, you actually see an eighth card, you both can identify the card, or you just see it and don't even put it in your hand. Like, obviously, me and Chip are talking about, like, if you play Marnie and draw seven cards and then shuffle your hand, that's a double prize penalty probably, right? Or even maybe worse, right?
It might be but worse because the deck is ordered off of Marnie.
Yeah, so we're talking about specifically, you know, you get Marnied, your opponent Marnies you, you draw four, and you, like, see the fifth. Or the fifth goes to your hand, but you immediately, both you and your opponent immediately identify it, know what it is, so it can easily be put back on top of the deck, right? Those are the situations we're talking about, where it's like, one card, we know where it is, we know where it should be, right? And those ones feel like, it's definitely a little bit, it feels just too harsh to be a double prize penalty.
So that's definitely something I think both of us would like to see kind of maybe looked at, changed. These type of changes take forever, it feels like, though. So if this discussion is being started now, we might see it updated in the rules in like 2 years or something like that. But
yeah,
who knows? We'll see.
Might be well.
We'll move on from that, though, to everyone's favorite segment. Guess That Flavor Text, where each week Azul or myself picks a card and reads the little bit of text in the bottom corner to the other person, and they have to guess what Pokemon we are talking about. You do get access to three lifelines. If you don't use any lifelines, you get 4 points. For each lifeline you use, you lose a point. And as always, those three lifelines are what set the card is from, what stage the card is, and read an attack name. It is my turn to pick a card to read to Azul, and of course, we would love for everyone to be playing along at home. Azul, how you feeling? Are you ready?
I'm ready. I'm not too confident. I think, like, I don't know if you're ever confident going into these anymore, but yeah, I have no confidence, but that means there's nothing to lose, and I'm feeling comfortable with taking another L and getting 0 points.
Whatever confidence I had died in, like, episode 17 or something like that.
Like, but I feel like once one of us gets, like, a two-pointer or something, that's going to reinvigorate the other person to actually try a little bit harder. But we need one of us to get one to get things back rolling again.
All right.
So hit me with it.
We'll see if maybe this is your chance to get reinvigorated this week. All right, here's the card. This Pokemon keeps its heat-sensitive head cool with ice. It fishes for food, dangling its single hair into the sea to lure in its prey.
Okay, go again.
This Pokemon keeps its heat-sensitive head cool with ice. It fishes for food, dangling its single hair into the sea to lure in prey.
Okay, so immediately I'm thinking of Ice Cube. But I know... Wait, isn't this just Ice Cube? So its head is a block of ice, but I know that's not its
heat-sensitive head cooled with ice. Nothing about a block of ice.
Yeah, but there's a block of ice on its head to keep its heat-sensitive.
You are adding the block of ice part.
No, but like that's still ice.
It fishes for food, dangling its single hair into the sea. The hair.
And I feel like Ice Cube, doesn't Ice Cube have a hair sticking out of the ice cube at the top? I feel like this is Ice Cube. I also, like, in my head, I'm like, there's, like, a Pokemon. Like, you know, it has, like, whenever you, like, I can see a Pokemon with a single hair, but I don't remember the name of it. But it might just be Ice Cube that I'm thinking of. So I think it's Ice Cube immediately, because, like, all those things sound like a penguin. His head is a block of ice, but I know that's not his head. I know the block of ice isn't actually his head. I don't know why I know that. So, I mean, there's a block of ice on his head. That's ice keeping his head cool. I in my head, like, when I think about Ice Cube, there's something coming out of the top of the Ice Cube. And then penguins eat fish. So I'm on Ice Cube as of right now. But there's no reason for me not to use, even if I used all three of the lifelines, I'll still be ahead of Chip. So we're going to start with what stage the card is.
It is a basic.
Now I really want to. All right, we're going to go with, give me an attack name.
Icy Snow.
I don't remember Ice Cube's first attack, but there's also like three Ice Cubes in the format. I don't remember. One of the attacks is Block Face on the one that I care about or cared about for this tournament, but I don't remember the other name of the attack. So we're going to go with, just to use them all, because even 1 point is a huge advantage. What set is the card from? Even though this one basically does nothing for me. Go ahead.
It's from Evolving Skies.
I feel like this has to be Ice Cube. I'm guessing Ice Cube. We're locking it in.
It is Ice Cube, Azul.
What? Why did I just guess Ice Cube? Why did I not just guess Ice Cube? I had it.
This was maybe the best chance for you to ever get 4 points. You psyched yourself out. I gotta look. It is Ice Cube, and it is the Evolving Skies Ice Cube with the Block Face attack and the Icy Snow attack.
Yeah, there is a little hair sticking out of the top of the cube.
He's got a tiny little hair sticking out of his head. Yeah. Now, I'm not going to lie. The card I was going to pick at first was the Ice Cube from Fusion Strike, which flavor text says, it's the hair on its head connects to the surface of its brain. When this Pokemon has something on its mind, the hair chills the air around it, which I think would have been much harder for you to get.
Yeah.
But I thought it would be really funny if I switched and did the Ice Cube that you were just talking about at the start of the episode. And so I just clicked on it quick and read the card. And I was like, okay, yeah, we can do that. But I only really read the second part. I didn't really thoroughly read the first part of the flavor text that says this Pokemon keeps its heat-sensitive head cool with ice. So, admittedly, maybe a little bit of a punt on my part, but
yeah,
you did.
Almost a huge punt. I almost did it, too, because like I know that's not his head. I don't know why I know that, but I know Ice's head isn't literally an ice block. And then I was like, I think there's like something sticking out of the top of the ice cube. And yeah, it's the one hair that apparently it uses to fish.
Yeah, and it's connected to the surface of its brain as well.
Of course.
So I'm sure there's several people out there listening who got 4 points this week. So if you're one of them, let us know in the comments of the YouTube video. Azul gets one measly point this week, but does move ahead 4-3 on the scoreboard. So
yeah, I just used all the lifelines so I didn't get too far ahead.
Right, keep it reasonable. Yeah, you're going easy on me.
All right, so we had I am up now. I am up by a point. You'll have your chance to redeem yourself next week, Chip, and maybe tie it up again
for the next 15 episodes.
Yeah, we had Salt Lake City Regionals this past weekend, but finally somewhere else in the world besides America is getting a regional, because there's only been one Latin American regional, and now this is there was a European regional.
Yeah, there was a European special event.
Okay, so I was wrong. But the format does progress. I mean, for us, the format was pretty short. We had our two North American regionals, and those are gone and done. But now it's Europe's chance. They're gonna have two regionals in this format, and we'll see how the format kind of progresses. So we're gonna talk about that next. And I think, oh man, there was something I was gonna say, and now it literally just I just forgot it. So go ahead, Chip. We got the new what do you expect? What do you think is gonna be the number one deck? I think it'll be Palkia, but what do you think?
So I mean, we're gonna just be talking here about how the meta is moving forward in general. Obviously, the only place that has regional championships left in this format is Europe, but there's gonna be tons of box tournaments, tons of 5Ks and stuff happening all across the world. So, and of course, local leagues and all that stuff. So there's still plenty of information to be gleaned from these this discussion, even with not having any competitive events really to talk about. This is gonna be the LIL regionals. And Stefan Ivanov actually won the last LIL regionals from France, so I'm sure he'll be looking to defend his homeland once again, making another deep run. And Stefan's one of those players that when he's playing in a tournament, he is someone that you would never be surprised to see winning the event. So,
yeah, definitely always a threat. And I actually think there are a couple, it might not be for LIL. There's a couple North American players going to Warsaw,
That's right, yes.
I don't know if any of I guess LIL's probably a little bit close to Salt Lake City, so that's like going to be quite a transition for anyone who went to Salt Lake City. And probably if you had to choose between the two, you'd probably go to Salt Lake City if you live in North America over LIL. But I think Warsaw, there might be a couple North American players right over there. But yeah. What was I going to say? Oh, yeah, the meta. So we know what happened in Salt Lake City. But where does it go from there? I think Tina and Kiram, there's too much. There's too much for how good the decks are. I think Palkia will become our new front runner into the rest of the format. But do you disagree?
I wouldn't be surprised to see that. I do still think Tina and Kiram will be reasonably represented at the event, probably still in the top 3 to 5 most played. Maybe Kyurem will fall a little bit farther than Tina. Though this is going to be many of the European players' first chance to get their hands on the new set in a new competitive format. So I think a lot of them will lean on the Tina, most likely. I think we'll see a lot of them try, maybe not Tina, but like Lost Box, like Lost Zone type decks. We'll see maybe Mirage Gate Zone. We'll see the Sableye Charizard deck. We'll see some Giratina stuff as well, because people want to try the new thing. They want to at least give it a shot, and it is powerful. It is good. Palkia, you know, been there, done that. It's good, but, you know, we got to try the new stuff out as well. So I would actually agree. I do think that likely Palkia will be the most played deck, because for people who their main goal is to just get championship points, try to get that world's invite, it's really hard to pick something besides Palkia just because it's that powerful, and it is, I mean, if you choose to play it, you have a pretty decent shot at least coming away with points on the weekend.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I've been saying for a while now. I feel like Tina in general is just bad Palkia. Like, I feel like it just is a worse Palkia.
I don't think it's
like,
fair like to compare the two, though. They're so different in how they play. Like,
no, but they both, just their matchup spread wise, like they basically have they're both can kind of beat anything. I think Tina is a little bit better against the fringe decks. Like, you're going to come away with more dubs against stuff like Blissey or Arctoralodon or maybe Gudra, I guess, depending. But I don't think Gudra's that bad of a matchup for Palkia. I think it's pretty close, especially, like, if you look at Hale's list with no Ordinary Rots, you can't even play around Echoing Horn. That's a pretty big deal against Palkia.
Yeah, Caleb lost to Hale on stream. But it was, like, I think... Caleb's list was like pretty greedy on like the basic Pokemon count, and like the Avery's from Hale definitely hurt a lot, so that was a factor.
Yeah, so I mean that's how I feel about it. I feel like Tina is just like, it just every time whenever I look at the you know the matchup percentages against the field, I feel like Tina just is just like, I think you're slightly unfavored against Palkia, and I think Palkia overall has a better matchup spread against the field. They both can, like I said, both very versatile decks, can kind of beat anything. But yeah, like you said, this is what I was actually, the point I was going to make before I forgot to say it, which is that, yeah, ton of great players in Europe. We have not gotten to see anything from them at all. So definitely curious to see what they bring out. I could also see Gustavo potentially. Gustavo sometimes shows up at European events, and having not had an event for a while, I wouldn't be surprised to see someone like Gustavo make their way over to Lille or Warsaw as well.
Like in school now, though, like he's like deep in, like, I think he's like in med school or something like that.
Yeah, he's so in med school.
So it's kind of a hard ask in the middle of med school to take a 5-day trip over to Europe, I feel like. But
yeah, possibly. I mean, we still saw him show up to a lot of pretty much everything else. The NAIC
was
Worlds,
he at med
like,
school last year already? I thought he started this year. Oh, okay.
I saw some tweets of him tweeting out about some stuff when he was in school. Yeah, so I wouldn't be surprised to see someone like Gustavo show up at these kind of events as well. But the European players, they just haven't had a chance in this meta yet. So a lot of great players and potentially a lot of cool ideas kind of undiscovered.
I mean,
right?
Europe has so many innovators as far as deck building goes. I mean, who knows what the heck Sander's going to show up with, right? Like,
well, Sander's actually not going because Sander tweeted out his list. Yeah, he tweeted out his list before... Salt Lake City saying, I'm not going to be able to make it to Lille. What I would have played. And actually, I talked to someone who said they almost just like played. Oh, it was actually Cyrus was like, I almost just sleeved up Sander's 60. And I was like, a good thing you didn't do that, because like you definitely need to put in time with decks like that beforehand for sure. Because it almost felt like Sander was just like baiting people to play. To play his concoction.
I mean, surely someone did, right? Someone has to have just seen this and sleeved it up, right?
I mean, I know Caleb looked at it and was like, yo, what if we just took Sanders? Like, I was like, no, we're not just going to take Sanders' crazy 60 cards and run it. Although I would love to play Mewtwo V Union again. Definitely would not be confident. I don't know how good or even how confident Sander is in that build. But looking at it, I would not have been confident picking up that like the night before the tournament at all. Definitely would have had to put some time with it and then evaluate whether or not I would want to actually run it or not. But
I'm innovators over there for sure. I'm expecting like the meta decks obviously to do very well. The stuff we've seen, like, I think we will see Palkia be pretty heavily played. I wouldn't be surprised to see Mew with a pretty decent uptick compared to the American regionals, honestly. But I would also expect some of the top level players, like the Stefan, like we mentioned, maybe the Schultz brothers, maybe Pedro as well, Fabian, Mehdi, all of them. Like, these players love to innovate, love to deck build, and I mean, are not afraid as well to play something that looks a little weird and looks a little janky. So, and when you have that many high skill players playing or innovating, trying something out, I'm not going to be surprised if we see something wacky in top eight from one of them.
Yeah, I think they'll definitely be. I think there's a lot of room in the format for there to be some wacky stuff. Like I said, especially when you know what like the top three decks are probably looking like, it's probably going to be Kyurem, Tina, and Palkia. Like, even though I don't have as much respect for Kyurem and Tina, a lot of players do, and I think a lot of players, like a lot of top players, did gravitate towards and have been more gravitating towards Giratina. And I think Henry Brand even said that that's what he would have played if he was played in a tournament this weekend or next weekend. I think he would have said he was going to play. He would have played Giratina himself as well. So. A lot of top players like it because it is like a very versatile deck, right? That's why a lot of top players like Palkia, right? Don't really have many bad matchups. You can solve any of its big weaknesses against some of the matchups with some with like a tech card or two. And Giratina can kind of do the same thing. Like I said, I think it is worse overall than Palkia, but it that's why a lot of people like Tina. But there is still, I think there is still some room out there for some crazy stuff to eventually happen. I hope it does. And I hope there is something out there, because if we just see more of the same, not going to be as exciting. I don't think it's going to be. As crazy as for Reggie and Cut, maybe, but hopefully there is some cool stuff to come out of Lille.
And speaking of the Reggies, how heavily do you think that Reggies should be played / respected? So if someone sees the success, watched the stream this past weekend in Salt Lake, they're like, yeah, Reggie seems solid. How many people are going to see that and choose to play the deck? And how many are going to choose to play things that counter Reggie?
Well, I mean, I think if you don't know what to play, I would just play Reggie. Like, if you don't know what to play or don't have, like, a favorite deck, then I would just play Reggie for sure. If you don't have anything, like, super cool or new or innovative, same thing. Like, I would just play Reggie's. And then the real call is just, like, should you play the Yellhorn or not? And that kind of comes down to, you think people will play Ice Cube? Because if everyone's playing Yellhorn, not really a ton of reason to play the Ice Cube. If everyone's playing Yellhorn in the Reggie deck, why play Ice Cube? But then if they cut the Ice Cube because of that, then you can cut the Yellhorn. So that's kind of the only real thing to question, but I think the deck is still ridiculously strong. I don't see a reason to like not play it unless like everyone goes kind of the Jake Gearhart route and puts double Lost City and Palkia. Probably wouldn't play Reggie then, but I don't think that's going to probably be the route many people take to kind of answer Reggie. So Ice Cube would still probably be the number one threat.
Do you maybe put Boss back in to help Flying Pikachu?
Maybe that's like another weird one. Another thing would be like Gudra. Do you play a Miltank for the Gudra matchup?
Sure.
How many other decks will tech one of Miltank for the Gudra matchup? Does a basic Psychic in Gudra counter Miltank? A couple questions there, because those are also, that's another deck. The Gudra deck is another deck that just loses to, you know, a one of Miltank. So are some, I assume some decks out there could, I mean, a lot of decks out there can easily adjust and just add a Miltank, right? So
yeah, I mean, if people are just copying Gale's list, which I that's another question, you know, taking a look at the decks that just won and got second place, the Arc Peak and of course the Arc Gudra. I mean, do we expect to see some copy pasting happening between not just the winning list, but the top eight, but I guess mostly the winning list, like Gudra, is it going to be much more represented percentage wise in Lille than it was in Salt Lake?
I think probably not too much more.
I think it was probably the same. I think it's probably like similar counts.
But I think
sure.
I think it probably should end up being represented more. I think it's probably a better deck than people are going to probably give it overall credit for. And I don't think anyone's really going to add the Miltank. Like, I don't think anyone's going to play the Miltank, right?
After listening to this.
Maybe this conversation I'm having right now completely alters the meta from Lille and quad Miltank wins. But every deck in top eight has one Miltank in it. But I would say if I felt confident in Gudra, if I tested it out finally, I haven't tested it yet. If I tested Gudra, felt confident in it, I would probably run it for Lille, because I don't think anyone's going to add the Miltank. And the meta is perceived to be very wide, even though I don't think the meta is actually as wide as people think it is, because people are choosing to play decks that fall more into that tier two, tier three category, where they're still solid, they're still good, but there should be more people playing the tier one decks. But that's kind of not what's happening, which isn't a terrible thing. It's just kind of how the meta is evolving. So at least the Gudra still being like a really powerful play, I think, overall. And that's probably what I would play if I felt confident. But I haven't, like I said, I haven't tested it, so I don't know how, if I like the Tina matchup or anything like that.
All right, one more question. Kind of a little bit of a short discussion here on Lille, because I think a lot can be gleaned from our discussion on the results of Salt Lake. So if you're wondering our thoughts on Dex and stuff, definitely check that section of the podcast out if you skipped ahead to this point. But
the biggest thing with Lille is, and it's nothing we can talk about, just like what's going to be the cool new decks that people bring, I think, right?
Well, and my question, yeah, so that's what I'm looking forward to seeing, is like especially some of these players we mentioned earlier, seeing what they've been testing and working out with.
Yeah, we have no clue what that is yet.
Yeah, well, outside of the unknown, most likely deck to make top eight in France this weekend that was not in top eight of SLC. So things like between, I guess, mostly going to be Mew, Radiant Zard, Sableye decks, Zoroark, any of these type of things. Which of the decks that was not in top eight of Salt Lake do you think is most likely to be in top eight this weekend?
Let me take up Reggie's kind of like really gave us a lot of options here, didn't they? For Reggie and Cut, so that gave us a lot of options. I'm going to go with, that's hard. I mean, I think Mew's the obvious choice because the Lost Box decks, the Lost Gate and Sablezard, just haven't seemed very powerful in the meta overall. So I think Mew's kind of the obvious choice, but I'm going to go with Zoroark. Let's go with Hisuian Zoroark. Maybe someone just dodges the one prizers and beats down everything else.
I'm going to say Sableye, Radiant Zard, mostly because I feel like it would not be a big surprise to see Tord play the deck once again. And Tord shows up with the deck, I wouldn't be surprised to see him, of course, in top eight of the event. And he's kind of been someone the last few formats that he's kind of picked a deck and stuck with it. You know, he did that with Urshifu in the Brilliant Stars format. He played that for pretty much most of the format. He played Palkia in Milwaukee and at NAIC. He did change it up for Worlds with that the Vikavolt deck, but yeah, I mean, he's kind of been sticking with the same thing, it feels like. So, on the back of Tord, I'm going to say Sableye Charizard.
Fully all in on Tord with the Sableye Charizard. There was a couple, actually, speaking of Vikavolt, there was a couple of Vikavolts at Salt Lake City, which is pretty cool to see.
Yeah,
Lockyer with it.
We saw Charlie Lockyer with it. We had him on the stream in round three. And then also Liam Halliburton, the Seniors World Champ, was playing it. Both of them ended up getting championship points, I believe, but neither of them made day two. I think there was a couple like Vikavolt-ish decks in day two, though. There's definitely some strategies to be explored there. I do think it's great against kind of a more narrow meta. It's great against the Comfy Engine decks. It's great against Palkia, but against the Arceus decks, it doesn't feel nearly good enough, right? So Arceus,
yeah, Kudra, really good against Lost Zone, but falls off against just like the big Pokemon that attack.
And like, I don't even know how good it is against something like Reggie, right? Like, you're three hit KOing a Reggie.
Yeah.
So
once you get a rock online, like once you just find the energy and attack with Regice or Reggie Rock, they're in trouble. So yeah, probably, I mean, I guess it depends. Like, if you KO two Regice and that's it, then they don't have an attacker set up, then you kind of win because they can't use Ordinary Rod. But getting to that point seems like it takes a while.
You can also manually attach your energies because you have time. You also play,
that is, yeah.
You play eight draw supporters in the deck, which is not something most decks are doing right now. So it feels like the Vikavolt deck is not going to be great against Dredgies.
Yeah, it doesn't sound right. Who knows? Maybe later in the year, though. Vikavolt's had its moments. Maybe it'll get one again.
Well, Azul, I think that's going to do it for this week's episode. We really appreciate everyone listening, and thank you all for the support as always. Please be sure to leave us a review on your favorite podcasting platform wherever you are listening right now. And if you're watching on YouTube, be sure to subscribe to the YouTube channel. I actually looked at the analytics right before we started recording, Azul, and did you know that only 50% of the people who listen to our videos are subscribed to the YouTube channel? What the heck are they doing? You know, it just takes one little click of the button. Wow. Click subscribe. Easy enough, right?
Yeah, it's super easy. Click the sub button. Help us out. Support the content. We appreciate it.
Yes. And thank you all so much for listening. If you want to connect with us and keep up to date with us, the best way to do that is going to be on Twitter. You can follow myself at TrainerChip. Azul is at Azul_GG. And you can also follow the podcast at Uncommon_Energy. Don't forget, every single Tuesday, 7 a.m. EST. Good luck to anyone playing in Lil Regionals this weekend or anything else going on. And that's going to do it for us. We'll get out of here. Thank you so much for listening.
See ya. Peace.